This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. President Trump addressed the United Nations General Assembly yesterday and promoted the accomplishments of his administration. The president also took aim at Iran and China during the speech. He criticized Iran for sowing destruction in the Middle East, and he called out China's trade policies. The president's speech was in line with his America First stance and was met with some seeming disbelief from members of the General Assembly and laughs at least one point from delegates. Joseph Greco is a professor of political science at Duke University. Joe, welcome back to Central Time.
Rob, thank you for having me on the show.
Well, let's take a quick listen to some of President Trump's opening address. This is something that caught a lot of attention. Here it is.
Yes.
In less than 2 years, my administration has accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country. America's so true. Didn't expect that reaction, but that's okay. America's economy is booming like never before. Since my election, we have added $10 trillion in wealth. The stock market is at an all-time high in history, and jobless claims are at a 50-year low.
So, Joe, laughter or no, what do you make of the president opening up with this pitch about how successful the United States has been under his couple years in office so far?
Yes, it seems like, reading some of the commentary, that this is taken from his stump speech that he's been using for the midterms. I suspect it makes him feel comfortable. It also is a way of for him to lay down a marker that he has been successful. Let's face it, there's a lot of pushback both within the United States in terms of media coverage and checking on the factual accuracy of some of those statements. And I suspect that people who think back to people like Dwight Eisenhower or Harry Truman, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, that statement doesn't pass the laugh test. In other words, when you hear it, do you feel like you should laugh or could laugh, or do you repress it? And it doesn't meet that test. So it is what it is, isn't it? This is our president.
And maybe at a more substantive level, the president, again, this is nothing new, but he made the case, he said, for patriotism as a guiding ideology for the United States and other countries over what he described as a globalism. What do you make of him reaffirming that?
Yes, I that was one of the sentences that popped out, and I'm still trying to get my head wrapped around that, because patriotism is a characteristic to which we all aspire. I think most people wish to be patriots, but patriotism isn't a doctrine. It doesn't inform you, for example, on whether we should try to have lower tariffs or higher tariffs. You can be on either side of that issue, whether we should be thinking about more investment with Japan or less investment, be in favor or against it, but still be a patriot. It's a concept that it's a way of thinking. I know his staff people are looking for a way to systematize his thinking. That was one way to do it, the patriotism versus globalism idea. I also noticed he used a phrase that I hadn't seen before, something called principled realism, that he wishes that he wants to suggest that that's a way of offering his thoughts in a kind of a framework. So I suspect his staff is trying to do that, trying to put together or rearticulate or translate his kind of disparate views into a systematic way of thinking about foreign affairs. And these are lines that are being used, and perhaps they'll at some point actually come together into some sort of coherent line of thinking. But I would have to say, people who are in favor of working through the WTO, they can be patriots. Those who don't think we should be working through the WTO, they're patriots. So I don't think patriotism is a doctrine.
President Trump seemed to consistently make the case that participating in global institutions, maybe like the WTO, maybe multilateral trade agreements, the World Court, other institutions like that, came at the expense of American sovereignty. And he's saying we, the United States, should tip the balance back toward sovereignty over these multinational institutions and recommending to other countries, hey, you ought to do the same thing. Did you see that?
Yes, I think there are two issues. One is that he is ascribing problems the United States has had in trade in terms of having a competitive economy, on the one hand, to the behavior of certain states such as China, and he can be on strong grounds on some of those claims. I think there are problems with currency manipulation on the part of China, forced technology transfer, theft of intellectual property. There are real problems out there, dumping, suppression of unions in the country that work to the disadvantage of the United States and in particular U.S. workers. On the other hand, he seems to think that the World Trade Organization is an instrument by which China undertakes those actions. Actually, it's one of the ways by which people can raise concerns about Chinese behavior. We should remember, who was it that wanted to bring about a World Trade Organization? It was the United States. And before that, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, the United States. Usually these institutions, such as the IMF, they are not instruments that work against the United States. They are often instruments by which the United States works with other partners to achieve common ends. So it's a case where Mr. Trump has some elements of correct analysis, the problem of China, and he conflates them with these arguments that, I have to say, don't easily stand up to strict scrutiny.
We're talking to Joseph Greco right now, political science professor at Duke University. He's with us to talk about President Trump's address at the UN General Assembly yesterday. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about President Trump's speech before the UN General Assembly yesterday. In the speech, President Trump talked about the strength of the United States economy under his administration and criticized Iran and China. Joe Greco is with us, political science professor at Duke University. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. We'll go to a caller now. Karen is with us in Shell Lake. Karen, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. One of my concerns is, as was mentioned, was the oppression of unions in this country. We see that in China, and we're seeing an awful lot of it here, in Wisconsin in particular. And I was wondering where that places us in terms of how we look at wealth. We seem to be paying more attention to dictatorships like North Korea or Russia than we are to our allies, and I wonder how that plays out on the world stage. And I also wonder, when we talk about the bull market, how little impact that has on people who are poor.
Well, I want to jump in, Karen, because we have not much time, and you gave us a lot to work with there. Let's start with that point. Karen's concerned, Joe, about the U.S., she says, paying more attention to dictatorships than U.S. allies. Can you address that?
Understood. Karen's right that it's totally understandable that in a speech at the UN, there's going to be attention paid to international security problems, since the UN is one of the venues where such issues are addressed, especially at the UN Security Council. More broadly, though, I think she's right that there's a imbalance in attention paid by the Trump administrations to the sources, for example, of relative wage stagnation and income stagnation, especially for families in the middle or working class sectors. And the idea that tariffs are a solution for that, I think, is misguided. Instead, better unions, stronger unions in the United States, stronger worker rights, better working conditions for workers in third world countries abroad would be a better solution. One thing that's missing in the Trump administration is a serious discussion, for example, or any kind of policy regarding vocational training, apprenticeship programs, the kind of programs that make Germany, for example, a very strong exporter, notwithstanding the fact that they have very high labor costs, wages, and a very strong labor, a very strong unionized labor force. So I guess that's why I think that I understand the appeal that Mr. Trump has to a lot of people with the discussion of tariffs. Tariffs, though, are not going to produce a stronger working class.
I want to peek in on what President Trump had to say about Iran during the speech. Yes. Here's part of what he had to say.
Iran's leaders sow chaos, death, and destruction. They do not respect their neighbors or borders or the sovereign rights of nations. Instead, Iran's leaders plunder the nation's resources to enrich themselves and to spread mayhem across the Middle East and far beyond.
And Joe, President Trump, of course, critical, very critical of the Iran nuclear deal in the presidential campaign and afterward. What did you think of what the president had to say about Iran?
Well, it's very hard to disagree with him in some respects. And indeed, most of U.S. allies, for example, the French president, Mr. Macron, today at the U.N. Security Council basically said, Mr. Trump, you're right about Iran. Iran does sow discord, does sow violence. It is pursuing a ballistic missile program that is of concern. The question is to address those behaviors, to persuade Iran not to undertake those behaviors. You have to ask yourself, does breaking the nuclear deal, which was designed to address a particular problem, namely the steady march by Iran towards the ability of having enough enriched uranium to build atomic bombs, whether breaking that treaty gets you to the point where you can address these other problems. And I'd have to say, 2 years on, it's not clear that that strategy is working. Rather, keeping the nuclear deal, but also then raising these other issues, which is what the Europeans want to do, and I think they're on pretty solid grounds, might be the smarter strategy. This strategy by Mr. Trump divides the United States from precisely the countries we need to put pressure on Iran, and those are Iran's major trading countries, partners, namely in Europe.
We'll leave it there for now. Joe, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yes, Rob, it was a great pleasure to be on your show.
That's Joseph Greco, political science professor at Duke University. He joins today to talk about the address President Trump delivered at the UN yesterday and U.S. foreign policy under the Trump administration. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Law and Order Special Victims Unit has been on the air since 1999 and has aired more than 430 episodes since its debut. Over the last 20 years, the show has delved into many issues that a lot of shows would steer clear of, including incidents of sexual assault. Our next guest is here to talk about the staying power of the show and its plots that were often ripped from the headlines, as they say. Meredith Blake writes about television for the LA Times. Meredith, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, 20 years on the air, that's quite an achievement. It's in, the record zone for primetime dramas. What is it about Law and Order Special Victims Unit that stuck around so well?
I think there's a couple things. I think it's two contradictory things, right? I think there's, on the one hand, there's a strong connection between the audience and the characters on the show, specifically Mariska Hargitay's character, Olivia Benson. But there's also the procedural aspect of the show, which means that there's a close-ended case nearly every single episode. So you can just kind of dive in and watch. You know, you're at the gym on the elliptical, and you get hooked, and you want to watch it, and you get a beginning, a middle, and an end in each episode. And I think that combination keeps viewers hooked. You know, you can always just dive in when you want, but you also have a strong personal attachment to the character, to the main character, Olivia Benson.
Yeah, a lot of things that people call prestige TV or a lot of the award-winning shows, they're serials. You, to understand what's happening in this episode, you kind of have to have seen what's come before, and it seems like that's the direction of a lot of shows. This is different, though, and it's kind of a benefit for them, you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's certainly been a trend for the past 5 to 10 years to have these heavily serialized dramas where you jump in to, say, an episode of Game of Thrones in season 3 and you'll be utterly lost. SVU is not like that. SVU, you can jump in and there might be some stuff going on with Olivia that you don't totally know what's going on, but you will, you know, the bulk of the show will be about whatever the case of the week is, and you can just dive in and have a good time and be done with it. And I think this show kind of splits the difference in a way that's unique and has made it very popular and given it really unexpected longevity in television.
Let's get a taste of the show now with a listen to a scene from an upcoming episode, season 20, I guess, of Law & Order SVU.
We talked to Sam's friends, teachers, teammates, and coaches.
Yeah, he's well-liked. He gets good grades. He's on the travel baseball team. He volunteers at an animal shelter. No history of being bullied. And his teachers, there's no red flags there.
Okay, what about the family?
John owns a beverage distribution company. Molly is a stay-at-home mom. They've been married 20 years, no history of DV. Neighbors got nothing but good things to say about him.
And the brother, Brian, he's been in detention a few times, fights mostly, but everybody we talk to say he and Sam are close.
Father said that they were together all weekend. Is there any chance that Sam ventured off by himself at any point?
I don't know. He was with Brian and John in Stillman County on a hunting trip. And everything's by the books, licenses, registered rifles.
So what the hell are we looking at?
Something that Sam said to me in the hospital, that whatever this was, he said that he needed it to happen.
So maybe he was experimenting sexually.
It's possible that he had an encounter with the predator upstate. I mean, it's not uncommon for a teenage boy to wander off.
So in a lot of ways, there's the team at work. We do love a good police procedural in this country, don't we, Meredith?
We sure do. Yeah, I mean, you there's a lot of talk about how broadcast television is fading, but consistently year after year, you know, shows where people solve crimes are always a big draw. I mean, not always, but, you know, consistently a big draw.
Now, this show took the formula of Law & Order, which dealt with crimes in general, and it's targeting mostly at these sexual-related crimes, and this is something that could break two ways. You could see it as really shocking and exploitative in some ways, or you could see it as, we're tackling these issues that we're afraid to talk about. How do you see the show kind of threading that needle?
Yeah, it is tricky. I mean, the show has been criticized as exploitative, but I think in general, the power of bringing these stories into people's audiences across the country for 20 years is the most important thing here, that this is a show that's getting people to talk about consent, that's getting people to think about these issues, to talk about survivors coming forward and not being ashamed of naming, you know, the perpetrators of the crimes is a really important thing. And I think you can't devalue that. Yes, there's kind of an inherently sort of exploitative quality to it, that you're churning out stories week after week of terrible abuse. But that's not unique to this show. That's something that we see in kind of every show that portrays violence of one kind or another.
As we're seeing even this week with Why I Didn't Report hashtag, a lot of people in who do report assaults say they haven't been taken seriously by family members, authorities. You write that the victims of these attacks in the show are treated generally very sympathetically by the main cast.
Yeah, and that's a conscious, apparently from my conversations with the writers and with Mariska, that's a conscious effort on the show's behalf. It's maybe one area where the show kind of takes some slightly poetic licenses, that the law enforcement in the show, especially Olivia, tends to be sympathetic to the accusers. And that's not to say that law enforcement aren't sympathetic, but oftentimes their job requires them to be more skeptical if they're, say, building a prosecution against someone. They have to come at someone's claims from a skeptical vantage point. But the show has always, you know, not always, but it, generally speaking, is sympathetic to the survivors, and that's what I think makes it powerful. You'll never hear Olivia Benson asking a character what she was wearing or how many drinks she had in an accusatory way.
You talked to, as you mentioned, the stars and creator of the show. They started in 1999, way before the Me Too movement was around. How did they talk about what we're seeing in American culture on these issues over the last year?
I think it's interesting. I mean, I think there's depends on who you ask. I think in some cases, Dick Wolf, who's this
the original creator of the series and kind of the godfather of the Law & Order franchise. You know, he refers to Mariska as the godmother of Me Too, which is maybe, I think he's being slightly hyperbolic, but I think the way he sees it is that this show has really helped spur a conversation around consent, around all of these issues that's helped really change public perception about, various crimes of a sexual nature. I think Mariska, she's also kind of, who plays Olivia, the main character, she's also become a real off-screen ambassador for it. She has a charity that's dedicated to survivors of sexual assault. She's produced a documentary about the rape kit backlog and really helped drive attention to that issue. So I think that they're all happy to be a part of the conversation. And, you know, I don't know that they're ready to claim credit for it, but I think they're certainly happy that the show has helped move the dialogue forward in some way.
Talking to Meredith Blake, TV writer for the LA Times, talking about the show Law & Order Special Victims Unit and about its longevity. It's kicking off its 20th season this week. Meredith, it was interesting. You wrote that there was one topic the show intentionally avoided tackling, and that is teen suicide. Why is that?
That was interesting. That came up in multiple conversations, and that is because, according to research, there is a noticeable uptick or a noticeable correlation between portrayals of teen suicide and specifically teen suicides where they go through with it in films and television and the teen suicide rate. And for that reason, that's just something that they don't touch on this show.
How is the show?
Dick Wolf, I suppose Dick Wolf. He said he has 5 kids, I believe, and so for some, for him, it's very personal. They don't portray that.
Now, the show, as I said, entering its 20th season, has the show evolved over the years, or does it feel like they're on the same formula they've been on since season one?
It's absolutely evolved, and I think that's key to its longevity. In the first, 12 seasons, it was Olivia Benson and her partner, played by Chris Maloney, Elliot Stabler, and it was kind of what in showbiz talk they call a two-hander, which is, you know, a show where there's two main characters who kind of feed off of each other. And, you know, their dynamic kept the show going for a long time, and then Chris Maloney decided to leave, and then it really became more about Olivia Benson and her life, and it became her story, and Mariska became the protagonist. And I think people sort of, you know, fans of the show see there's kind of two chapters in the show's life. There's probably many chapters in between those two chapters, but those are the big two eras in the show. And you know, as the show has gone on, it's gotten a little more serialized. As we talked about before, there have been some multi-episode arcs dealing with things in Benson's life. There was one famous one where she was kidnapped by this serial rapist, and that was, I think, a 4 or 5-episode arc. So they've dabbled a little bit and done some more inventive storytelling outside of the traditional procedural format, but it's still at its heart a procedural.
Now, we've seen over the last couple of decades a decline in viewership for broadcast media in general, TV shows, primetime TV, just because there's so much other stuff people can watch. How has Law & Order SVU done as far as ratings over the years?
It's been pretty consistent. I mean, it's seen some erosion just like any other show, but it's got a pretty stable core of fans. It's never been, like, quite up there with, like, an NCIS in terms of ratings. You know, that's a huge hit, and you know, I think that's been on 16 or 17 seasons. But it's been a stable performer, and it's also a huge, huge performer in reruns. It's on cable, it's on USA, it's on ION, it's on Hulu. You can watch it kind of any time of the day or night. And that's, I think, helped sustain its popularity that, you know, it's always finding new viewers.
I know you can't predict anything in the world of TV. Things can change. But in talking to the cast and crew there, did you get a sense that they want to keep doing this for another bunch of years?
I did. I mean, I think Dick Wolf, who is the kind of, you know, he's like the impresario of this world, he seemed very determined to at least break the record, because right now it's tied with the original Law & Order and the long-running Western Gunsmoke. And I think they all want to get to 21 to at least break the record. Beyond that, I think it's a matter of, it really comes down to whether Mariska Hargitay wants to stay on board, because she's really the crux of the show at this point. point. Without her, I don't think you'd have the show. And she seems to be really excited and creatively plugged in and excited to keep going. So who knows? They're at 434 episodes, and, you know, maybe it'll go to 500.
Wow. That'd be a heck of a binge watch. Meredith, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Meredith Blake is a TV writer for the LA Times. She joined us to talk about the 20th season kicking off this week of the show Law & Order Special Victims Unit and why it's had such staying power now for two decades.